again, and welcome to Kitchen Finks. We are a casual Magic podcast focusing on 60-card multiplayer and occasionally branching out. I'm your host, Kendall, and with me tonight is Ian.
Hey, guys.
No Will tonight, there was a Will tonight, but this is Ian and I are recording later. There's about a 50-50 chance that this is the second half of one file, or possibly two episodes went up this week. I don't know. But I did do an episode with just Will earlier this evening where we talked about Will-ish things. This episode, I'm going to talk to Ian about Ian-ish things.
All right. Ian-ish things.
So first off, you and I did play some casual Magic this past weekend.
We did. There was a little too much EDH for me and not enough 60 cards, but I guess technically it was a balance of 2-2.
I think if we'd have played longer, we probably would have played more.
I think that was my biggest issue, actually. We only played for, 2 hours?
Yeah.
So it was a little short.
That was. It's just, that's just how sometimes you just don't have time for stuff. Because I pushed it till a little bit later in the evening because I thought that would be easier for people, but then I guess not because people had to wake up in the morning and stuff. But we played for about 2 hours and we got two games of 60 card in and two games of EDH, and none of them were – nothing was bad. I thought all of them were pretty good games.
Yeah.
I forget. Was this your first time playing 30 Life EDH?
I believe it was.
So did you notice a difference in the feel of the games?
The games were faster. So in both games, someone came out strong. The first game, it was me. I was playing my Ural the Mistalker deck, which I had actually touched up a little bit to actually include some auras. I kind of did the technique that was taught to us by Captain Red Zone when we had him on a few weeks ago, and I laid out all my cards, and I kind of rebuilt it, sort of, to be a little stronger than it was. It just kind of dithered around before, and the way the first game worked the other night was I managed to stick a few auras on Ural, and he won the game pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And then the second game, you were the one that got big fast by, having 14 mana on turn 4 in your Omnath deck and then playing a bunch of stuff and killing everyone.
Yeah. Now, in game 1, I don't know if you technically won with general damage, but you won with your general.
Yeah.
So I don't know that the 30 life would have affected that one as much. And also, I think, although you came out strong and I came out strong, if somebody had found an answer to your Ural, in that game I would have come out, and probably been very dominant. I had some very powerful stuff that I was going to be playing in a few turns, and I'm sure that the same was true of Dwight. These were also the EDH games were 3-player games, and they. So that's also relevant, I think, is that it was 3-player, so you're a little more susceptible to the one guy coming out really strong
and
nobody having an answer to it.
Yeah. Neither of you were playing board wipes in that game, so, one big creature with hexproof is really all it takes.
I think he had board wipes in his deck. Was he playing
just didn't get him.
'Cause he was playing his blue-white deck, right?
Honestly, I don't even remember. I think he was. Because there's a morph creature in it.
Yeah.
Okay,
he had blue in both decks, but I'm pretty sure he has board wipes in the deck. It's just a matter
just
of drawing them and having them, at the right time. Also, I encourage you to... I realize the other issue that you might have with EDH is that you have tons and tons and tons of 60-card decks, and you don't have that many. You only have one EDH deck.
Well, I have three, but the other two are basically the pre-con commander decks that Wizards came out with a few tweaks.
So maybe you should build one or two more commander decks, and then you'd be able to have a more varied experience.
But I did really enjoy our 60-card games, and I think Dwight, our third player, did as well.
Yes, Dwight did, definitely. And I mean, and the other Ian was there for the 60-card games, and he's already a 60-card player. I think he plays both.
I think Dwight liked both the decks that I handed him.
Yeah, he definitely did. He especially liked the Urzatron deck. And I talked to him. He mentioned it the next day at Dungeons & Dragons, and I told him, I said, you know, you can't really play Urzatron in EDH.
Yeah, you really can't.
That's why there are certain things you can do in 60 card that you just straight up can't do in EDH. I actually felt like I was a little bit unhappy with the power level of the 60 card games. I felt like we were all playing very, very powerful decks. And I would have liked to play bad cards.
Yeah, I think my decks are steadily getting more powerful. I have some weaker decks, but they did not make an appearance.
Right. And I mean, that's what happens when you play that. I think also the issue is, and this is sort of always an issue, I think, with casual Magic, is that it's so hard to get people together to play. And then when you do get them together, it's your time is so limited.
Yeah.
So it's like it's always a little bit disappointing that you didn't get to play every single one of your decks before somebody had to leave.
I always feel like that. Like, okay, I got to pick two decks to play, and then I lent two out. So four of my decks saw the light of day, but, you know, I brought like 30.
Right. And this is the first time you've played 60-card Magic in
months.
You know, months. Yeah. Which, you know, so that it's, I think that's, and I've found that to be an issue. Like when I had when I was playing like 15 decks, even though I was playing 60 card multiplayer twice a week, like I was still feeling like I wasn't getting to play this deck or that deck. And then also like there's certain decks, like I'm seeing this with playing EDH too, cause I have five EDH decks, four EDH decks right now, something like that. And I always want to play my Omnath deck in at least one game because that's like, so, you know, me,
I get to this point where it's like, I want to play a deck multiple times because like I'm trying to work on it and trying to tune it. You know, sometimes the only way to know that a card isn't right for the deck is to be playing the deck and then draw that card and say, you know, I don't actually want to cast this.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you need multiple plays, but with the deck, playthroughs of the deck in order to do it. But then I also have other decks I want to get to. It's just, I need to, like, be constantly playing in order to get my fix.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, like, and when you, especially when you think about it, like, you know, when I play competitively, I have, you know, two decks that I'm, or one or two decks that I'm rotating through, and I'm playing, you know, in an evening, I'm playing four rounds of three games each, you know, so I'm playing 12 games.
You really get to know your deck very well.
Yeah. And that's just at the tournament.
Yeah.
After I've spent all week, you know, playing match after match after match after match. So you really get to know that deck, and then you build like an EDH deck. And I think EDH decks are even more so than 60 card decks because there's all that variance. Now, the nice thing is I can play my Omnath deck every time we play EDH and it's a little bit of a different experience. But the downside is I always feel like, yeah, like you want to work on the deck, like you want to be better at Magic.
Right.
All right. So, we're about 11 minutes into the call. Will and I were 18 minutes into the call when we started the interview. So that sounds about right. So Ian, we'll start at the very beginning. How did you get into Magic?
So back a ways in high school, there were always some guys kind of playing, you know, somewhere like in the cafeteria, whatever. You know, I watched a little bit, and then two other guys that are in my classic Magic group, which kind of stopped playing, came to the school. They were like a junior and a senior, and they had a bunch of cards, and they fell in with some of my people who had some cards, and so I'm like, it's time for me to learn. Mm-hmm. So I was like a sophomore or a junior at the time in high school, and they taught me, and I bought my first pre-con deck, which was a Kamigawa deck called Spirit Flames, red-green deck, and it all went from there.
Yeah. Now, speaking of, now you played in high, so you played in high school. You went to
I went to Darby. Yeah.
You went to the other high school from me.
Right.
Now, I remember, and I didn't play Magic in high school, but this is a format that I've always known of it, but never actually seen real people play. In the interest of, so in high school, when you're like playing at lunch or whatever, you're you're doing like a, you know, a five player game and you have like 20 minutes to play. People did a format, they called it two up, two down, where basically Rites of Flourishing was always in play.
Huh.
You would draw two cards on your at the start of your turn, and you could play two lands. Did you ever play that format?
I never even heard of it.
You've never? It must have been, because the only reason I'm thinking of it, because, you know, there's probably some overlap between Magic players from the two sides of the suburb of Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
but yeah, like that's what they always at Davidson. They always played two up, two down, and I think I even like when I taught myself to play Magic when I first got it. Like when I was like, you know, fish bowling with my two starter decks.
Yeah.
I think I actually played two up, two down with myself.
Huh.
But I just realized that it's, yeah, I mean, and it's a completely different game. I mean, it's, you know, it's a complete, I just realized that I'm, that's of all the crazy casual multiplayer formats, I don't think I've ever played it like in real Magic time.
I did get to play a ton in high school though. Once I had decks, knew how to play. Mm-hmm. We were all in marching band at the same time. So anytime during band, after band, before band, it was always Magic.
Mm-hmm.
Not as often at lunch because it's hard to get a group of, you know, there's four or five different lunch periods. You didn't have everyone in the same one.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, before school, after school, all the time, Magic.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, that was, there definitely is like a phase in your life where wherever you go, you feel like...
And your friends are there. Yeah.
You see people playing Magic.
I don't miss much about high school, but that's one of the things.
Yeah.
You know, my Magic playing friends were always around. I saw them every day, and we played Magic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, playing Magic every day is good. Fortunately, Magic Online lets you play Magic every day. I know you're not a big fan of that, of Magic Online, or you haven't had.
Well, yeah, the trick is finding like a meta that you can play in.
Right, right, right.
I don't want to necessarily play competitive all the time.
Uh-huh.
And the anything goes room is, well, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some good experiences playing EDH online. I haven't really tried to do like just straight up casual multiplayer, like 60 card, or I feel like most of the time when it was like just regular, like whatever casual multiplayer, people were playing like 2000 card decks. Just because you can do that on Magic Online, I guess.
I was thinking about trying to play, Momir Basic.
I've heard good things about that.
Yeah, I've heard it's a fun format. All you have to do is buy the Momir, right?
Right, right.
And then it just lands. And then, yeah, and it's a level playing field, and I think it sounds fun.
Yeah, I've definitely heard people...
But Momir himself isn't that cheap. still.
Well, don't they have a – you can get it – I mean, well, that cheap, depending on what your definition of that cheap is. I think you can get – you can buy it from the – like the or at least you used to be able to buy it from the – just from the store for like $10.
$10? I thought it was more than that. I don't know. Maybe I'll look into it again. If it's really $10, I might do it.
Yeah. I mean, it was
– and you can go online and read about people debating what balance of lands to play in their Mjolnir deck. Right. You don't just do 12 of each basic. You're supposed to play, like, more mountains and I don't know.
So is it the Avatar Mjolnir Vig? Simic Visionary?
Yep.
Is what it is? Okay, MTGO Traders has it for $8.20.
Okay, that's not bad.
So, so that's probably less than what it is on the store.
Yeah, I'd pay $8 to be able to play Mjolnir, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's not something that I've done, but I've got stuff on Magic Online that can keep me busy. so, that's how you got into Magic. So and one of the things I wanted to do with this is make it a little bit new listener friendly. So you have some very specific philosophies about what casual Magic is and how to keep casual Magic casual and the like.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that for a little bit? I mean, that's what this entire 60-some-odd episodes has been about casual Magic and keeping casual Magic casual, but what is your philosophy on
that? So my overall philosophy is in the importance of maintaining your play group and the social, code of honor, code of conduct that ensures that everyone's having fun. It's my belief that if there are unfun strategies, you should not play them. Which means, don't play discard, don't play, a lot of discard, maybe a little bit would be fine. But even like Thoughtseize is not very good in multiplayer. Don't play land destruction, don't play decks that, don't play stasis decks, don't play decks that combo out, on early turns. Just be smart about not making everyone mad, because if you make everyone mad, they might stop playing with you, and then you've lost your group and you can't play at all. So, that's in a nutshell my philosophy. Don't play stuff that isn't fun for everyone.
Okay. That made me think. Recently, somebody posted on Twitter that I follow. I don't know who it was. They said, if you build a deck to annoy your opponents, it's going to annoy your opponents.
Mm-hmm.
So don't do that.
I have some decks like that. So I have some decks that I will play in duels and not play in multiplayer. I like to duel people sometimes. We do that even less than we play multiplayer. But when I handed, so the two decks that Dwight asked for in our game the other night were the white-blue heavy control one, and I'm like, I told him when I handed it to him, I'm like, I don't usually play this deck because it's not very fun to play against. And then the other one was Eldrazi, which is, kind of the same deal. It's kind of brutal, it's kind of nasty. And so I have those decks. I think there's a time and place for them. But
yeah.
I also have a lot more moderate decks, and those are the ones I generally go to in a multiplayer game, especially when I don't know the decks that I'm playing against.
Yeah. I think that Eldrazi deck is fragile enough that you could...
I think you're probably right, but it did kind of crush everyone.
Yes, it did, because he got Emrakul out pretty fast.
On like turn like 5 or something.
Yeah, but I mean, he really... I felt like he really accelerated well, and there weren't really nobody was disrupting him.
Yeah.
I think if there'd been a board wipe, or if because Emrakul dies to board wipes, I guess he would have gotten to make someone sacrifice all of their permanents first, but I don't know. I felt like, and even so, it was like he played Emrakul and it was not the end of the world. I felt like it was not the end of the world.
Well,
now, granted, he did
kinda
win.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of was.
but I don't know. I mean, he did get it out. Like, it, I felt like it performed really well. And also, it was like a notch above the rest of the decks that we were playing. I mean, I was playing my Spiders deck.
Yeah, and I was playing some Vampires deck.
I could have chump blocked his. I could have chump blocked his Emrakul. No, I don't think. No, I wasn't playing my Spiders deck. What was I playing?
What are you playing in that game?
Oh, I was playing my Auras deck that I had never played before.
Oh. They didn't even know.
Yeah. It was a fast game. I mean, you know, that's how it is.
And Ian,
he didn't.
Ian was also playing Tron, right?
Uh huh.
Other Ian.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I killed his man acceleration early, and he didn't get there in time.
Right. Yeah, that I've thought a lot about trying to do the mono green Tron thing on Magic Online, but it just seems like
I like it.
Like it's fun, and I think it's actually really good for a multiplayer setting, because it's a cool flashy combo ish thing, but it also is fragile. I mean, if you disrupt the mana accelerator, if you disrupt the color fixing or if somebody else comes out even faster than you, because, well, it does some crazy stuff by turn five, as soon as you play Urza's Tower and people see that you're going to be playing giant things really fast, you're putting a target on your face.
Yeah.
And you're also, like, it doesn't have very strong defenses early on.
Yeah, there's a couple of defenders that produce mana, Axe Beam Guardian and the Overgrown Battlement. But that's not going to stand up to a assault.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to stand up to three people attacking you with 2/2s or four, or, well, I guess 2/2s, but 3/3s, you know, or if somebody else, because, I mean, people can, you can do crazy things. You can accelerate stuff out, because that's what, that's an issue that I've always found with Urzatron, even in the green-red version that I play, that, like, you're kind of open for the first few turns, and so if you anger your opponents or you scare your opponents, then you're kind of screwed. So that's, I mean, I like the fragility of the mono-green version. I like it. I just, yeah, it was just, it just did well. So
those decks are actually kind of against my philosophy a little bit because they can be unfun, but having those like for a tough group or if I'm dueling, I like to play those. I don't mind playing good decks in duels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's
as long as I'm not like beating up on someone. Right.
Right. And I mean, that's something too, like it was kind of cool when I remember playing with that, with the group, your work friends, for a little while, and sort of everybody was playing very powerful decks.
Yeah,
and it
not
is
like
kind of
super
fun
powerful
to play
decks, but like reasonably powerful competitive
yeah,
ones.
Well, more you know, the power creep of the playgroup was up. So it was kind of cool seeing people playing flashy, doing flashy things.
Right.
You know, as one thing, I kind of think that Magic is like, it's yes and. It's like every kind of Magic is good, except for Popper. I don't like Popper.
Well, Popper can be good too. It's just the actual competitive Popper metagame is terrible.
Yeah. That's what I meant. Okay, so I talked about when I talked to Will, we talked about his cube, and I was thinking the equivalent for Ian is you have 30 decks.
More than that. Yeah.
What are some of the and we've done whole episodes on pet decks before, but what are some of your favorite pet decks? Maybe some that are or maybe some that you like haven't really talked that much about before.
So my current favorite, I probably have brought it up, is Birthing Pod. It's green, black, white. I always make sure to play it now because it's relatively new. I built it, well, it's probably been a few months since I built it, but I haven't played Magic that many times since I built it, so I try to play it whenever I can. I really like it. I love it in multiplayer because the creatures are resilient, and it has like kind of a toolbox of useful things that I can search up with the pod, so it can kind of run with any group.
Yeah. I'd really like for them to print something like Birthing Pod again. Because it's kind of unlikely that they'll reprint it unless it's in like a Modern Masters 2.
Yeah, because the thing is, it's got a Phyrexian mana symbol. Yeah.
But it's also hard to justify them making one. Maybe if they made it and it was like strictly worse.
Yeah,
or something.
Or maybe
like
there's a couple other things that are like kind of like it, like Mimic Bat or Fauna Shaman / Survival of the Fittest, like that. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. It's not exactly like Birthing Pod, but you can get kind of the same feel out of it. I could see.
Yeah, I guess there are a few things like that. I just like I'm thinking like maybe if they, I wonder if they printed Birthing Pod. Because my concern is, and this is the competitive side of things, you know, my concern is I don't want a modern deck where you play six Birthing Pods.
Right.
But, like, I wonder if they printed Birthing Pod and it was, like, basically the same as Birthing Pod, except for instead of Phyrexian mana, it was just straight up green mana. I wonder if that would be, like, if that would be bad enough to not play in modern, but still.
You couldn't bail life to make it cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't seem very good. Like, it's a 4-mana artifact, so you're not.
It costs 2 mana to activate it.
And 2 mana to activate. That doesn't seem too crazy overpowered, but it would still have that effect. Because the problem is that Birthing Pod's an expensive card now, and it's. But it's just such a unique. And it's a card that just gets better and better. And the problem is, you can play it in in casual, but from a little bit of a more competitive standpoint, or even from a casual standpoint, you know, the other Ian said, he said Birthing Pod. Oh, what's your infinite combo in the deck?
And I'm like, yeah, no, I don't play an infinite combo. I just play value.
I just, cause I really liked playing Birthing Pod in standard. And I really liked. I didn't actually play it a lot. I played it a little bit, but my deck
is based on the standard version.
But I liked. I sort of liked the idea of it. I like decks that you can justify having one of.
Yeah, it's like perfect for multiplayer. I can, you know, it can adapt to whatever circumstances. It's got resilient creatures. It can play a decent mid range game. It can win without Birthing Pod, like it did the other day. I did not get a Birthing Pod, but I drew Elish Norn, and you know.
Right. And it has it has inevitability.
Right.
Which is always good.
Yeah, it's just a blast.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I would like, because I really, I don't know, I want to play. I feel like if they printed something like that in. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how. What the best way to do it would be. And I mean, I guess, yeah, they have, there's cards that you can use to tutor for creatures. And I like the idea of Fauna Shaman. Yeah. Cause Fauna Shaman is what you pay. It's a creature.
You discard
a creature and search for a creature.
Yeah.
But it doesn't go into play. It,
right. It goes to your hand.
Which is, so that's a little different.
Yeah. You still have to cast it.
Yeah. Because that's the really cool thing about Birthing Pod, is that you don't have to cast the creature. But Birthing Pod.
Yeah.
What's of your decks, what do you think is the most out there concept?
Like way out there.
Like way out there.
Well, there's that Malfiger deck. That's pretty out there. What else is out there? Ninjas isn't too far out. I've got a Snakes deck.
So most of your decks, I feel like, are, even if they're based around, a lot of times they're based around a theme or they're based around a mechanic.
Yeah.
And so they're not crazy. The power level varies.
Yeah, some of them are pretty crazy. Some of them aren't.
Yeah. The power level varies it's kind of nice because it's like you have, it's almost like a documentation of Magic from the last however many years.
It's definitely true. Because there's stuff from different, based around different blocks and mechanics, and it's just kind of a weird mix of stuff. I think my favorite decks, though, like, are ones that, and this is kind of, you know, the whole multiplayer thing, are ones that aren't too brutally powerful for a while, but either have some resiliency or have an inevitable endgame. Like I have a self-mill deck. You know, it just kind of does its own thing. It doesn't play, like, hugely powerful cards for a while. But, you know, once it gets enough things into its graveyard, it will find a way to win. It'll, like, make tons of spider tokens or tons of wolves or make a huge splinter fright. Or, you know, if it goes long enough, it'll beat you. Well, I had another example all lined up. I've already forgotten what it is.
Do you have that aura from, it's either Theros or Born of the Gods that gives the creature +1/+1 for each wolf you control?
No. Oh, that's like Raised by Wolves or something.
Yeah. I really, really like the idea of playing that on a Kessick Cagebreakers.
That would be pretty cool.
Like, just have one floating around in the deck. And I mean, it is like a solid card. Like, it gives you, I mean, it's kind of expensive, but it gives you, I think it costs like 5 or something, but it gives you 2 wolves or something when it comes into play. Like, so it's not like, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter if you have other wolves. It's good enough in and of itself. But, because I got to play it in my intro pack league deck. But yeah, I really like the idea of doing that with Kessick Cagebreakers. Cause also, it protects your Kessick Cagebreakers. Because that was always my issue with self-mill is that you play the Kessick Cagebreakers and it's like a... How big is the Kessick Cagebreakers? Like a...
It's like a 3-3 or something.
Like a 3-3. It's not very big. Yeah.
But usually when it attacks, if you stuck your graveyard enough, you get enough wolves that it's a lethal attack anyway. It usually does die, though, on its first attack.
And then it gets big, and then it makes your Splinter Fright even bigger.
I gotta say, my Ninjas deck, like, I haven't played it a lot yet, but I made some recent changes to it, you know, kind of like tuned it a little bit, got more copies of the few ninjas, of select ninjas, right? And it can also do a little bit of a toolbox because, like, the one legendary ninja searches for ninjas when he hits.
So you can decide whether you want to be able to draw a card or kill a creature or bounce a creature.
Yeah, basically. Well, or, you know, and then there's like Sakishima Student and the one that Ink Eyes that can reanimate for late game stuff. But actually, I really like how the deck is performing now in my play tests. It can kind of like, it does like a pretty good tempo game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like ninjas. I'd really like to see them bring them back, even if it wasn't a ninjutsu mechanic. Like just a completely different ninja.
When do we get Return to Kamigawa again?
Yeah, supposedly Mark Rosewater tweeted.
Yeah, he like dropped something about it randomly, and it was like some far off year.
Well, I was thinking it was like. Not next year, but the following year.
I thought he had made some joke. Maybe you saw something different than what I saw. But I thought he had made some joke where, like, someone said they were teaching their daughter how to play Magic, and he's like, I'm sure she'll go on to win Pro Tour, return to Kamigawa in 2026 or something.
Oh, okay. I don't know. He may have said so. I heard it secondhand that it was, you know, but whatever. When I listen to his drive to work, he's sort of addressed when people talk to him about Kamigawa, because Kamigawa is thought of as one of the sort of failed sets.
Yeah.
And he actually made a really good point that he thinks a lot of people who are playing now didn't actually play at the time of Kamigawa.
Huh.
And a lot of the people that really like Kamigawa now like the idea of it more than the execution of it.
Right.
Which that's certainly me, because I've played with Samurai a little bit. I've played with Ninjas a little bit.
And there are some good cards in there. Like, you can pull off a Soul Shift deck. It's hard, but you can do it.
Right. And I really like Splice. I got to play, when I was playing Modern Burn, I got to play Lava Spike and Glacial Ray in the deck.
Yeah.
And that's just really cool when you actually get to splice onto Arcane. It just seems like a really cool...
It's just free, man. I mean, it costs mana, but you don't use the card.
Right. Yeah, it makes me want to... It made me want to, like, just take all of the splice onto Arcane cards and
I used to play, like, Kadama's Might and Unchecked Growth. Unchecked Growth is, like, a 3 mana, +4/+4, and if it's a spirit, it gets trample. So it's not great. It was fine for back when I played it, but I would play it along with... Kadama's Might, which is +2/+2 and can splice for green mana. So
then it becomes +6/+6 and trample.
Or you can give it +8/+8 by then casting the Kadama's Might.
Oh yeah, again, yeah.
Right? So
and
I would
play,
like
play and you could play Kadama's Reach is Arcane too.
Yes, and Kadama's Reach is Arcane. So you can staple like a pump spell onto a ramp spell.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, there's some decent stuff.
And then you play a green red ramp tempo burn deck. I guess if you had like lots of small creatures, maybe. I guess, and also I guess if you're paying all this extra mana to splice stuff to cast expensive spells, you want the ramp.
Yeah, so that's kind of what my deck was for a while. That deck, I started with Spirit Flames. It was red-green with some splice and some soul shift and stuff. And it slowly evolved in over time. It eventually dropped the whole Kamigawa thing, left spirits and soul shift behind. But even to this day, like it shares a few cards with that original version, like Kadama's Reach.
Yeah. That's an obscure card that nobody plays. Man, I can't remember. That random obscure enchantment that let me play extra lands.
Yeah.
And then playing going land for turn. It's Gaia's something. Let's look it up.
There's not
real
that
fast.
Many cards that start with Gaia. Gaia's Cradle?
I feel like Gaia's Cradle is something else.
Gaia's Blessing? There's a lot of Gaia's things, I guess.
There's 13.
Gaia's Blessing is the one that shuffles here.
Guy's Embrace, Guy's Liege, Guy's Might, Guy's Revenge, Guy's Skyfall, Guy's Touch. That's
Guy's Touch, there you go. It has an activated ability for 0. You may put a basic forest card from your hand on the battlefield activated only any time you could cast a sorcery and only once each turn. So it does essentially let you play a second one, and then you could sacrifice it for 2 mana.
Yeah, that's the Oracle text. That's interesting that they changed the Oracle text, because the card says you may play one additional land put one additional land into play during each of your turns, but that land must be a basic forest.
So they changed it to an active
ability. Oh, it's because it's a basic forest. That's why.
No, it's really because the it doesn't count towards your... Do you remember where they made that change about how lands can be played, how multiple lands could be played each turn?
Mm-hmm.
I think they did it to get around that. The ruling says the land enters the battlefield directly from your hand but is not played. This means it does not count toward the number of lands played this turn and doesn't trigger abilities that would trigger if the forest had been played.
So does that mean landfall doesn't trigger?
I think so.
Might have to contact a judge or something. That's interesting.
There's like this judge chat thing that's always up, and there's people in it, and you can just go in there and ask a question, and you get an answer.
But because landfall triggers on enters the battlefield.
Oh, not on playing a land.
Yeah, I'll bet that's what it is.
I think you're right. So it should still trigger landfall.
Yeah. Okay, that makes more sense. That's weird. That's weird that they. I guess it's an old card. But the point is that you go turn three, you play that on turn two, then you go turn three, play your land, Kadama's Reach, get your or cultivate. I think is actually
yeah.
What I
put
play.
One into play tapped, another
put one
into
play
hand,
tapped,
and then, play
and then
that.
The other one in your hand, and you get to play it after
that
it.
Is
so you get
awesome.
Yeah, that was so. Turn four, I literally had six forests. Turn four to play my mana doubler, whatever it's called. That was pretty awesome. Let's see. Okay, so we're coming up toward the 45-minute mark, which is about when we started winding down with Will, so we'll keep these about the same length of episodes. Ian, Will is not here. So I'm going to ask you this question that I totally did not ask Will. It's completely different.
Your bonus question.
What do you really think of Will?
I like Will. I think he's a good guy. He doesn't play a ton of, like, 60-card multiplayer. He's always, he's got his group with his cube and his limited play. And that's definitely, I think a lot of casual groups do that. Cube is a thing. And it brings a different perspective to our cast.
Mm-hmm. That's funny that you say that, because that is actually... I asked him what he brings to the table, because I guess I asked you guys totally different questions. But I asked him what he brings to the table, and that's exactly what he said, is that he's got a different perspective of the casual, different types of casual play.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of what he does, and he doesn't do a lot of what I do, but it's two sides of the same coin.
Cool. Yeah, he said that you keep us from talking about whatever we feel like. you keep us focused. And then we spent like 10 minutes talking about podcasts and why you need to be focused and stuff like that. So,
off on a tangent.
Yeah. That was okay. It was supposed to be that was sort of where we were going. So I think we did good stuff here. Let me think if there's the story of you getting. I asked him he has a little more interesting story of how he got affiliated with the podcast. You got affiliated with the podcast because you'd played Magic with me, and I said you should be in a podcast.
I'm like, okay.
although I was thinking, like, remember like the first episode? I actually had show notes.
Did you really?
Yeah. Like, I had printed out show notes because we were, like, in person.
Yeah, that's tough.
And so it was, like, almost scripted. Like, the whole podcast was, like, almost scripted.
I gotta say, though, I really liked recording in person with microphones. but it's just not that practical.
Yeah, yeah. I'm recording with a microphone right now.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm going to sound really pretty.
I probably sound terrible.
You sound like... I think, to me, most podcasts... Like, I don't understand how podcasts' audio quality... Like, some of them sound so bad. Because, I mean, we don't do that much for quality. Usually, I'm just using the internal mic on my computer. You guys use what you use, and we're going through Skype, which, you know, isn't necessarily the highest quality of anything, but
I think mic quality is probably a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of it's mic quality. Part of it is that people are dumb. I don't know. It doesn't have to be that good of a mic, but, you know, you listen to some podcasts and it's like...
That did sound pretty bad.
I'm not like crazy echoey, am I?
No. Sound good to me.
I just realized that sometimes I use this soundboard, and if I can't hear myself, then I accidentally have the echo effect on. All right. Thanks for listening. Like us on Facebook, kitchenfinkspodcast@gmail.com. I'm at K Hallman on Twitter. Ian is at Lord of the Slith. And until next time,
don't be
a kitchen fink.